This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Could human forcing of the climate take us to a new dangerous state of deserts and a drying sea? That worrying look at extreme possibilities arises from a paper published in the journal Nature Communications in February 2016. The paper claims humans can create the largest known climate feedback mechanism, so we do need to know what it's about. Our guide will be Dr. James Casting. He's the Evan Pugh Professor in the Department of Geosciences at Penn State University. Casting is an award-winning member of many scientific societies. He's published countless scientific papers since his first in 1977, including some dead-on for this topic. Jim Casting has worked for and with NASA all over the place. He's also part of NASA groups researching astrobiology and possible life on other planets. Dr. Casting, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
We're going to need to understand some new things to get the message of this study by Max Popp and his co-authors. And sort of to motivate us, I want to read you something that the authors conclude. They say, this study verifies the presence of the largest known feedback mechanism for amplifying anthropogenic climate change. Do you agree with that?
Well, I wouldn't say it verifies the feedback mechanism. What they're talking about is cloud feedback, and that's actually very controversial. It varies from one model to another.
Okay. Well, I'd like to get sort of an introduction to the paper step by step. And to start with, we read this. Water-rich planets such as Earth lose water by photodissociation of water vapor in the upper atmosphere. Can you explain this further so the average person can understand it?
Photodissociation means splitting the water vapor molecule apart using solar ultraviolet radiation. And if you do that, you first convert H2O into H plus OH, and then you end up converting the OH into O and H, and so you have H atoms and O that recombines to form O2. So the hydrogen atoms, the H atoms, can escape to space, and then you're left with some oxygen, but the water is lost.
Okay, so this paper by Popper says, quote, but significant loss of water could occur over geological timescales, and I want to emphasize that, he's talking about long timescales, if the surface temperature were around 70K warmer than it is today. Now that's in Kelvin. Unfortunately, most of us only understand temperatures in Fahrenheit or Celsius. If this is an important trigger point for significant water loss, how much warmer is 70 Kelvin from our present temperatures?
Well, first of all, the authors misspoke slightly there. What they should have said is you can start to lose a lot of water if you get to 70 degrees Celsius mean surface temperature. And, you know, the current mean surface temperature is 15 Celsius, which is 59 Fahrenheit. And so about a 55 degree Celsius or Kelvin increase in temperature would do it.
Is that a sliding scale? That is, if the Earth warms 8 or 10 degrees C, as seems quite likely on our current path of emissions, would loss of water to space be increased at a noticeable level?
No, it's really not much of an issue until you get up to these very high temperatures, you know, roughly 70 Celsius.
Okay. And what is a moist greenhouse state?
Moist greenhouse, it's better to define a runaway greenhouse first. That's when you evaporate all the surface water and create a steam atmosphere. A moist greenhouse, you still have liquid water on the surface, but the atmosphere becomes very water-rich, and the stratosphere becomes water-rich as well, so that you can then lose the water by the process we just talked about.
Well, I'm glad you raised that because I'm wondering how this compares to the runaway greenhouse effect that James Hansen called the Venus syndrome.
It's a variant of the runaway greenhouse effect. And right now in the literature, the climate modelers are basically having an argument about whether you get a moist greenhouse on the way to a runaway greenhouse or whether you just shift directly to the runaway greenhouse.
And were you involved when James Hansen was doing early work on the atmosphere of Venus?
No, but I've worked on the Venus runaway greenhouse, and you know we may have picked up where he left off. I worked with Jim Pollack out at NASA Ames on this problem many years ago.
So, as described in this paper in Nature Communications, various models have tested the relationship of water vapor as a potent greenhouse gas and global warming, and the results have been conflicting or inconclusive, or maybe models can't even do it. However, the introduction of the paper does say, if clouds are considered, these arguments may not apply because clouds themselves can contribute to the climate becoming unstable. How can clouds contribute to a climate becoming unstable?
Well, it's because clouds have different effects on climate depending on how high they are, what they're made of, and how thick they are. So most low clouds, like cumulus clouds and stratus clouds, tend to cool the Earth because they reflect sunlight to space and it makes it cooler at the surface. But high cirrus clouds, which are made of ice crystals, actually amplify the greenhouse effect more than they increase the Earth's reflectivity. So they warm the climate.
And there's some discussion in the paper about human-forced warming versus the long-term warming we expect from the sun. And it's my understanding that over more than a billion years, far more, the sun will get hotter as it expands, eventually rendering Earth uninhabitable for anything living, maybe 3 billion years from now. Did I get that right, for starters?
Yeah, actually, not just 3 billion years. The sun's getting brighter about 1% every 100 million years. So in 1 billion years, it'll be about 10% brighter, and that in our models would be enough to cause a moist greenhouse and lose the water.
So we've only got a billion years left.
Only a billion, that's right. It's not that scary.
So one key question investigated in this paper is whether human-forced warming can mimic or duplicate the role of that warming sun we've just discussed. What did they find?
Well, they found that it could, and this was the interesting part of the paper. They found that an increase in CO2 by about a factor of 4, I think, in their model, pushed you up to a moist greenhouse. But, you know, you should qualify that because their base model was about 6 degrees Celsius warmer than the modern Earth. They had a model with no continents. And for reasons I don't entirely understand, it was much warmer than the present climate. So actually, the moist greenhouse is not as imminent as their paper might make it look.
Yeah, all right. Now, they say these cloud effects come due to a weakening of the large-scale circulation with increasing global mean surface temperature. What are they talking about?
That's the second cloud effect. They actually have two cloud feedbacks in this model. If you start from the base temperature and increase the solar forcing or CO2, then they get a positive cloud feedback because they produce deeper convection and more cirrus clouds. That's true of many models that the IPCC uses to evaluate global warming. But then when they go to much higher surface temperatures, the effect that you just mentioned kicks in. They get more widespread clouds, and they start to cool.
So I guess Venus is generally under a great cloud. Is that correct?
Well, the Venus clouds are made of sulfuric acid rather than pure water vapor. And they're photochemical clouds. They form from photolysis of SO2. They're kind of like Earth clouds, but in other ways, they're not the same.
Now, unlike Hansen's suggestions a few years ago, this paper finds Earth is more likely to enter a new stable state. Why doesn't the runaway greenhouse effect happen?
It's because of the second cloud feedback, which is negative, so that when their model jumps up to this warm, moist greenhouse state, but then when they increase the forcing pass there, they start to get negative cloud feedback. The clouds become widespread and lower, and that prevents the runaway greenhouse.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. We're looking at a disturbing new study from The Science titled Transition to a Moist Greenhouse with CO2 and Solar Forcing. And our guest is Dr. James Casting from the Department of Geosciences at Penn State University. The authors of this study describe an ocean which could be literally scalding hot. For instance, Wikipedia says the long-term global average surface temperature of the ocean is about 16 degrees C or 60 degrees Fahrenheit. This paper is talking about an ocean that's 41 degrees hotter C or 74 degrees hotter Fahrenheit. You'd be in there for about 15 seconds before you scald. Is this really possible?
It is possible, but, you know, we wouldn't live to see it because we actually, long before we lost the water, we would be cooked because we have a heat stress threshold, which is well below that.
Yeah. Do we know what the global mean land temperature might be if the oceans were that hot, or is that even worth figuring out?
It would be very similar. So if you have really warm oceans like that, you get a lot of moisture in the atmosphere. The atmosphere then has a huge heat capacity, and more importantly, it's very optically thick, so the temperatures would become very uniform around the globe, including on the continents.
And that sounds to me like a dead planet, except for maybe those bacteria that can survive around the rims of volcanic heat vents. Is that a reasonable conclusion?
There are hyperthermophilic bacteria that can survive all the way well above 80 degrees Celsius. So not all life would be extinguished, but most of the life that we're familiar with on the continents, including us, would be extinguished.
Are there other planets out there in that state?
Well, that's one thing that NASA hopes to find out. In our own solar system, Venus, we think, went through this type of episode early in its history, and then it ended up in the very hot state that it's in right now. But NASA's designing telescopes as we speak that will look for planets around other stars and see whether any of them might be Earth-like or Venus-like or somewhere in between.
Even with the climate change predicted by the IPCC, there's a lot of talk about deserts increasing, even while extreme flooding and heavy rainfall events also increase. I'm presuming from what I'm hearing from you so far that those changes in the hydrological cycle are just a tiny subset and not directly related to the extreme changes that Max Popp and his authors are talking about.
That's right. The Popp et al. Study is not directly relevant to modern global warming because it looks like it would go to a moist greenhouse with a factor of 4 increase in CO2, which you could do by burning fossil fuels. But really, you need another factor of 4 increase to go from the Earth's present climate up to their base state. So really, it would take more like a factor of 20 increase, 16 or 20, to get to the state that Popp et al. Talk about.
So if anybody takes this paper and then says, well, that shows we're just rapidly heading for extinction, they're going way too far.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, Jim Casting, perhaps the most worrying sentence, or like a death sentence really, occurs at the end of the paper's abstract. Max Popp and his group write, "Furthermore, there is hysteresis in the warm regime, and removing the imposed forcing does not, therefore, necessarily cause a transition back to an Earth-like climate." And for listeners, hysteresis is sort of like a memory that can drive further action from past states. Can you talk to us about the drivers that would prevent ever returning to an Earth-like climate?
Yeah, you should say hysteresis, and it's clouds in their model that give you hysteresis. In other words, the behavior of the system is not directly reversible. The best analogy is with an electromagnet. When I was a kid, I used to take a copper wire and wind it around a nail and then attach the ends to a battery, and you make an electromagnet. Well, if you do that to the nail several times, you can then take off the copper coils and the nail is still magnetized. That's because there's hysteresis in the magnetic minerals. So the climate system they're arguing is the same way. Once you get it into this moist greenhouse state, it's not that easy to get back down from there.
Well, given the large-scale uncertainties here and the roughness of the models available, as you said, to calculate such big changes, I'm going to call this moist greenhouse state paper a theory. Would you agree with that?
Yes. But as I said, it's testable not so much on Earth, we hope, but by looking at planets around other stars. And that's why the paper is really of interest to me.
Obviously, then, the latest report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the Paris talks, they wouldn't have even considered this theory of water loss to space.
No, they're not that concerned about that. But they should be concerned about human heat stress, which, as I said, kicks in well before all of these effects that Popp et al. Are talking about. You know, the IPCC is worried about many of the effects of global warming, sea level rise, human heat stress, changes in water availability. And so they're actually doing a very useful service for us all.
Where does a theory like this go from here? What sort of research is needed and how imperative is it?
Well, we really need to advance our study of Earth-like planets in general. We need for very different groups to be doing these three-dimensional climate models, because that's what determines the boundaries of the habitable zone around our sun and other stars. So I was very happy to see this NICE study, which references most of the work that has been done recently and should provide motivation for others to do the same types of things.
Do you think it's too harsh for me to say that maybe this largest known feedback mechanism is so far away the public doesn't really need to know about it right now while scientists continue to hash it out?
I think that's a fair enough statement. But those of us that are interested in habitable planets will pay attention to this paper.
Even without this paper, as we wrap up, are you personally concerned that we will wreck the climate that nature and humanity have depended on?
I'm very concerned. And, you know, as I said, heat stress is maybe the most imminent problem. We're not that far away from making a climate that's basically too warm for us to live in without air conditioning. And, you know, this is more true in the tropics than it is elsewhere on the globe. But that is something we could do to ourselves within the next, say, 50 to 100 years.
Yeah, I just did a show on that about extreme heat in India and Pakistan recently. And also in the Middle East, Abu Dhabi, places like that, they're approaching the combination of heat and humidity where it's just not safe to go outside.
That's exactly right. And so as the climate warms, those places would be the first places on Earth that might become basically uninhabitable.
Where should our listeners go to find out more about you and to track some of the work that you're interested in?
You can go to my webpage at Penn State, which I update some of the times. You can Google me. And if you're a scientist, you can go on Web of Science, which has access to all of my papers.
And there's a lot of them. Have you counted them up?
I think Web of Science finds around 180 or something like that.
We've been talking with Dr. James Casting, the Evan Pugh Professor at the Department of Geosciences at Penn State University. He's been in and out of NASA, as you've heard, and he's interested in other planets as well. You can find links to the work of James Casting, the full text of this paper by Pope et al., and other things that we've talked about here in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much, Dr. Casting, for sharing your valuable time with us. I appreciate it.
Okay, well, thank you for interviewing me.
Be sure and check my weekly show blog, including bonus comments this week, by the Moist Greenhouse lead author, Max Popp. That's from our private telephone interview. Blog readers get an extra helping at ecoshock.info. Please listen again next week as Radio EcoShock pushes the edge.